Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a food, health, and environmental journalist and media advocate, covering all the things that affect our personal health and our total health environment. And every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between everything in our world and how it affects individual, community, societal, and global health. On the show this week, I cover a lot of things. We've had a month of programming on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and net neutrality, which are important advocacy actions that are current right now if we want to continue to have a voice in our communities about what goes on and what we decide and what policies we instate in our society. And every week on Connect the Dots, we call attention to different initiatives, opportunities, issues in these dimensions so that you can participate as citizens and stand up for health and the health of our health, ourselves, our communities, and our habitat, the earth. I also, on this show, frequently cover the media and how the media, the worlds of television, communications, marketing, and publishing, shape our attitudes and impact what we believe and what we do with our society. And so today I am covering something very dear to my heart, which is giving more of a voice to women in the media, and we'll find out from today's guest why that is not so commonly happening, but now we have a new initiative where it is happening, more that I want you all to know more about. The guest today on Connect the Dots is Laura Fraser. She's one of three co-founders of She Writes. This is a curated, She Write?
Books.
Oh, She Books, right. Why do we have She Write there? Yeah. It's a curated...
There's another company called She Writes, so...
Oh, I see. You get confused with them. Yeah, I got it. This is a curated collection of ebooks written by women in all different styles that are, it's kind of a service that you can participate in, download into any kind of Reader, Kindle, Nook, or anything that you have, in order to read when you can and hear women's voices. And my guest today, who's just piping in there, is Laura Fraser, and she is one of the founders. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Laura. So glad to have you here with us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me.
So, you know, let me ask you, why is it important to hear women's voices? Are they being heard through mainstream outlets as you would like to see them?
Well, so I've been a writer for 30 years, and I've just seen the space for women's writing shrink and shrink. Mm-hmm. And basically, if you look at statistics of sort of the thought leader magazines, the ones that we sort of consider, you know, the most intellectual, the most sort of important in certain ways.
Like The Atlantic, The New Yorkers, is that what we're talking about? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Most of them are publishing between 70 to 75% male bylines. So that includes The Atlantic, Harper's, The Nation, even The New Republic, New York Review of Books, The New Yorker. You know, it's just kind of astonishing that in 2014, this gender disparity still exists in publishing. I mean, what's amazing is that of those magazines that have been around for a long time, The Atlantic and Harper's, the gender ratio is about the same as it was 100 years ago. And so one of the things that we wanted to do is to create a place where women writers would have a platform and be noticed in these sort of long-form journalism, short memoir, and short story lengths, novella lengths. It's everything we publish is about an hour read or so. It's a it's a juicy read, but it's not a long book. We wanted a place for women to be able to be published and for women readers to read all these great women writers.
You know, that's really interesting because, you know, we kind of think that, you know, the conversation that's going on and the way things are positioned and the attitudes and values that we share and promote as a society are kind of gender neutral. You know, the presumption is that if it's, you know, whoever's writing out there in the journalistic space, they're kind of neutral, objective, and they're, but of course, you know, there's going to be a lot of subtle differences if that so-called neutrality, which I don't actually believe in, you know, is filtered through an experience, you know, as a man or as a woman. I mean, there are going to be differences in experience and values, in attitudes and needs, all of that. And so I think it's really, you know, a whole lot of things get skewed when our public conversation is inequitable in the way that you describe.
Look at history and how history's been written. You know, it's all been written by men. And look at what we've, you know, focused on. Imagine if people had focused on women, if they focused on domestic lives. I mean, it's absolutely a filter, as you put it. You know, I don't want to say that women like reading this over here and men like reading that over there, and we're entirely different. It's more like a Venn diagram where there's a lot of intersection, but there are things that women tend to be more interested in and things that men tend to be more interested in. And for lack of a better way to put it, I would say that women tend to be more interested in the internal stories, the stories about daily lives, the stories about families and relationships, and men tend to be more interested in the external stories, in the adventures, in the stories about politics and power. And so what the media have focused on are the latter, you know, the stories about, you know, who's winning, who's losing, and, you know, what adventures are people having, who's going around the world in a canoe, you know? And that's a real loss. And I think also a real degradation of women's experience. When you have magazines that don't tell the stories of women's everyday lives, and of also the challenges that women overcome. Like, this is a really subtle thing. When you have stories about men overcoming challenges, you get the feeling that, you know, men are stronger. And if you tell the story about women overcoming challenges, you know, you would get that impression about women too, but the problem is that those stories aren't being told. And so we don't see the way, you know, women are dealing with serious issues in their lives and overcoming them with, you know, a lot of intelligence and grace and humor. And those are the stories that I think women readers really like to read. And so that's one of the reasons that we created this space for really well-written stories about, you know, women's lives, basically.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the dichotomy that you're drawing there, because I'm going to now throw you a little bit of a devil's advocate type question here, just warning you, here it comes, which is the following. I mean, I've observed what you're talking about, too, which is, you know, women talking about the interior space and you know, of course, there may be biological reasons, but it's also because women have been largely disenfranchised from the public space. And so there's a sense very often of, oh, I can't change what's going out there in the big, bad society. That's the male realm. Of course, this is changing, but I can only change what's going on in me. And then in an effort to kind of create equity and to value our own experience as women, I feel that we also, you know, we're kind of always arguing for that internal space as being the source of everything, which in many, of course it is, But it's also, that also, I believe, comes from a certain disenfranchisement in the public space. You know, there's that old joke when, you know, the couple gets married and he will take care, decide about the big things and she will decide about the little things. And the little things are, you know, every single thing that has to do with their home, their lives, what they eat, you know, and everything like that. And the big things have to do with, you know, what's going out there in the big bad world of our policies and government. And somehow that's excluded from being a female terrain. You know, and therefore women don't underparticipate, they don't feel empowered, and the way the news is reported and, you know, the way all of that goes, it's also shaped by male attitude and opinion. And I personally write in the public space more, and I'd like to see more, and more women are entering that space, and I'd like to see more coverage of that space from a woman's perspective. It's beginning to happen, but I think it needs to happen a lot more, or we have the same bifurcation where, you know, we pick the placemats, but the societal decisions that are made are driving global warming, you know, for example. And that's not just
sure,
a consumer,
you know,
decision, you know?
Sure, you know, and I think that it is really important not to look at this as a dichotomy and not to say, okay, we're going to create a space for women over here to continue to be as disempowered as they've always been and to write about these other topics and not participate in public life.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And that's not what we're doing. What mm-hmm. we're doing is creating a platform for women mm-hmm. to be noticed, which is a very different kind of thing. Because, yeah, women have been disenfranchised. But as you pointed out, women often do contribute in the public space in a different way. And so what we're doing is creating space for that. So, for example, we have a memoir called Ricochet by an amazing woman who was a reporter during the Central American Wars. Mm. And her story, Mary Jo McConaughey, her story is not only the story of the war and what was going on there, but the story of what happened to two women war reporters when one of them said, I've had enough, I can't take any more deaths. And the other mm-hmm. one said, you and I were in it together, I can't go on without you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a level of experience that's brought to a situation that is different than
mm-hmm.
if, you know, perhaps a man had been reporting about his experiences as a war reporter. And, you know, it's definitely not to say that, women shouldn't be or can't participate in the public discussion. It's about creating a platform from which they can and from which they can be noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And also essentially taking down one of the barriers to entry because one of the reasons that we have 75% in some cases male bylines is because women have been left out of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
They have been disenfranchised. And it's like, okay, we can be knocking on those doors for a long time without
mm-hmm.
having all of these women, without getting all of these women published. And
I think that's great.
Moment,
yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I'm just more interested in saying, I want to read these amazing women writers and give them
mm-hmm.
a space to write and, not have to deal with the kind of really subtle sexism that I think is going on
mm-hmm.
at, you know, the magazines. I mean, I've seen it as a writer and among my women friends who are writers. I feel like what's going on at these magazines where the bylines are so overwhelmingly male
mm-hmm.
is a combination of socialization and sexism.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, you know, because women have had, you know, centuries of being disenfranchised from the public debate, they're less likely to try. And of course, as you point out, that's changing, thank God. But there still exists what people have been calling the confidence gap And it's natural. If you look at a club that's mostly men, you're less likely to try to get into it. But there's also in terms of this confidence gap, the fact that a lot of women will try, they'll be rejected, and then they'll stop trying. And a lot of women will take a no from the Atlantic or Harper's or the New Yorker as they don't like my writing. They don't like me. And, you know, thank goodness a lot of women have gotten over that. And, but nevertheless, that still exists. They think, wow, you know, whereas a man is much more likely to just keep pitching. You know, be like, okay, well, I got a response. They said no, but great, I got a response. I'm going to pitch another idea. And if you talk to editors of these magazines, they'll say that the proportion of queries that they get is, you know, about the same as what they publish. So the fact is that more men are trying and trying repeatedly to get into these magazines. But then, so that's the socialization piece. On the other hand, there's the sexism piece. And that says that, the point of view that women have is not as important. And then there are also some assumptions that go along. So I've been a writer for 30 years. I am the New York Times bestselling author. I've won a lot of awards as a journalist. I'm just saying that to say that I'm someone who, you know, is an experienced writer. I was at a conference with an editor at one of these thought leader magazines was speaking, and someone asked him, what kinds of stories are you interested in? And he said, oh, you know, for example, I'm really interested in this story in Italy where scientists were basically prosecuted for not predicting an earthquake, which turned out not to be the story, but that was the example that he used. And it was something that I had been reading it about, and I went up to him afterwards, and I said, I'd love to pitch you on that story. I speak fluent Italian, and I know a lot of Italian reporters. His immediate response was not, sure, send me a pitch. His immediate response, automatic response, was, I was kind of looking for a science guy. So if you asked this man, who is a nice liberal man, if he thought that there should be, you know, equity in publishing at his magazine, I'm sure he would say yes. But what came out of his mouth was, automatically, I was kind of looking for a science guy. And that's the kind of subtle sexism that, you know, that we're dealing with. And we get those signals overtly and covertly. And I've seen ways in which I'm a member of something called the San Francisco Writers Grotto, which is a collective of freelance writers, and we've grown from, like, you know, 15 to 60. And over the 15 years that I've been involved, I've seen over and over how, you know, male editors will come to lunch, they'll talk to the male editors, they'll approach them, and the women are somehow just, like, you know, not as important. And that just continues to exist. And yes, there are some women, thankfully, who've been able to break through that. But if you look at the women who are sort of the top women writers who get, you know, asked to the table, they tend to be women who write about, you know, again, not to stereotype, but they tend to be women who write about sort of more male-oriented stories. You know, more male perspective.
It's really interesting because there are, there is sort of, you know, there are constraints and biases in, you know, in reporting and in nonfiction reporting that leave out a lot. For example, you know, on the climate change topic, we have a science-based argument. But what we also have is that people are overwhelmed by the social vectors that are all holding hands and participating in, you know, the kind of destruction of health and habitat on Earth. And unless we also talk about those those institutions, our feelings about them, our attitudes about them, people have no enzymes to digest the overwhelming challenge that we face as a planet. And yet, you know, the traditional stance of reporting is basically like, I report the science, and I report the projections, and I report, policy discussions, but I don't talk about how I feel about it, how you feel about it. And, you know, if as a woman reporter you talk about that, you're kind of deviating from assumed standard that's evolved, and you leave out the enzymes needed to digest the problem, and you wind up then with the situation that people are in, believe that the climate thing is happening, but they're not, you know, we're not talking about climate deniers, but they're not ready to participate to do anything to change that because they just shut down and feel too overwhelmed. So, you know, even the conventions of nonfiction reporting where anything subjective, you know, isn't there unless it's a kind of human interest story of somebody, you know. It's kind of gutted from the material just to be sort of neutral and objective and journalistic. Even that convention, I think, is one that excludes a female perspective and sensibility, because I think there has to be a way of doing, you know, kind of both together, even though that would be breaking ground and a challenge. And this also creates a values divide, I think, in the culture. Like, for example, when you were mentioning the war story that you published, Sebastian Junger, you know, lost his dear colleague photographer and his maid who accompanied him on his films, and he's made a film about that, and he's done an advocacy thing to protect journalists. I was present at a screening of the opening of his film dedication to his late partner and friend. It was extremely touching and moving and really incredible. And, you know, there was a question that was in my mind that I hesitated to raise my hand and ask, but one gutsy woman in the audience asked that question. It was like hanging in the air, which was, what do you feel about men going to war and the whole ethos and camaraderie that occurs there and then perpetuates the war games, you know? And a woman asked that question. It was the key question to ask after seeing this film for reasons I won't go into. But, you know, Junger said, well, men have always gone to war. This is what men do. This is where men bond. You know, and of course nobody wanted to hurt his feelings and say, you still think that after, you know, you've been covering this and lost your friend and everything, but, you know, but it just kind of hung there silently. And, you know, and I was, of course, thinking something much nastier along the lines of, gee, can't men find another way to bond? You know, another kind of experience where they depend on each other and can acknowledge their love and feeling for each other. I mean, can't there be some other way? Course, you know, now, of course, there are many other complex reasons why nations go to war. So it would be naive to just say that what he was picking up at the heart of the war experience is the sole driving factor in that. But I mean, I think right there you see the difference in values and perspective in what we enable and what we question that comes when, you know, a male experience predominates over, you know, the equity of male and female experience. So I really salute you with what you're doing there. So tell, you know, you say that you create a platform. What kinds of things do you publish?
So right now we're publishing fiction, memoir, and journalism. And our sweet spot really is memoir, again, because a lot of times women's experiences, women's lives have not been written about that often in a serious way. And there are a lot of books, you know, memoir has become really, you know, hot. It's become a hot genre. And the problem is that there's no space between a 1,200-word personal essay, which is what you might see in the modern love column in the New York Times, and a full-length memoir. And the fact is that, you know, a lot of stories just don't deserve full-length treatment. And so we're publishing at, you know, 10,000 words, and if you're not a writer, that's like a one-hour read. Because, you know, that's the appropriate length for a lot of stories. There's, you know, a big difference between autobiography and memoir. Autobiography is the story of a life. It's mm-hmm. a life where we're interested in, you know, the person's childhood. We're interested in how they became the person they were. There are very few people who hold our interest that way. You know, maybe mm-hmm. the autobiography of Malcolm X or Katharine Graham or Gandhi, you know. Mm-hmm. A memoir is a story from a life. So it's an experience. It's a story. And often it, you know, it's not a book-length story. There's, you know, a lot that you can say and a lot someone can convey in about an hour's read. So that's what we do, I think, uniquely, is create a platform for that short memoir that's, you know, that's not padded. I want to do a t-shirt that says no padding, short ebooks for women. And we're doing journalism. We're looking for more journalism. We need to be able to pay our writers more because journalism costs more because you need to spend time going out and reporting, which is one of the reasons why right now we're actually doing a Kickstarter campaign called Equal Rights with a W to help raise money for women writers and particularly to pay for more journalism from a women's perspective.
That sounds really great because, you know, one of the things that's happened in the blogosphere is that there's a lot of reporting, but, you know, when you have both a decline in paid reporters and most of those are men, then there are, you know, it's like the pickings to actually go out and do real reporting for women is really quite slim. And so I think that's a really important initiative. How do people participate in that if they want to contribute?
Well, thank you for asking. Mm-hmm. We're trying to raise $50,000 for women writers. So far we've raised 42, which is great, but we're coming near the end, and if you don't raise it all, you don't get any. So what they can do is go to Kickstarter.com and just search for SheBooks or mm-hmm. search for Equal Rights with a W, and mm-hmm. our campaign will come up. We have a video and, you know, a lot of information about SheBooks. So, mm-hmm. yeah, we're sort of coming down to the finish line and, you know, biting our nails a little bit, hoping that we get this. Because with $50,000, you know, we can pay a lot of women to go out and write an important story. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, just go to Kickstarter and look for SheBooks.
Great. Let's take our station identification break now. We'll come back. We'll just kind of do we'll hear from some other shows that are playing here on Progressive Radio, and then we'll come back. Stay with us, listeners, for more conversation with Laura Fraser of SheBooks about women's voices emerging through this new platform. Welcome back to the second half of Connect the Dots. We're with you every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Today's show, we're talking about publishing women writers with Laura Fraser, co-founder of SheBooks, a curated collection of short e-books written by women for women. If you missed the first half of the show and just tuning in with us now, make sure to go back and listen to the show, which will be available in archives later this afternoon. If you are enjoying the show, you can share the archive link with anyone else that you think would be interested in this topic, and make sure to like us on iTunes. So in the first half of the show, we were kind of discussing
the inequity for those who are just tuning in between the amount of the entree that women have in publishing to put their work out there as compared with men. And actually, as Laura Fraser was telling us, there's kind of a shocking inequity that in all of the major magazines hasn't really changed much for 100 years. That's why she and her very long-term professional publishing writers and colleagues founded SheBooks. You know, let's talk a little bit about how the platform works from the reader's perspective. You know, Laura, like how do people, what kind of readers are you attracting, and how do readers participate and get to read these wonderful things that you're publishing on this platform?
Thanks. So we are a digital platform, and people can find us at shebooks.net. And to read our books, you can download our app. You go to SheBooks, you sign up. You can either subscribe to read all of our books, or you can download them one by one. And then you download our app, and if you've subscribed, all of our books come up on the app, and you can just kind of always have something to read with you. Right now we have almost 50 books that we've published since the beginning of the year. So we're publishing at a clip of about 2 a week. And so, you know, if you go to shebooks.net, you can find out everything you need to know about how to read our books.
How many subscribers do you have? How many people are participating?
Well, you know, we just started our subscription service last week.
Oh, my goodness.
It's all very new. And I think if I told you how many subscribers we had, you'd go, yikes, nobody is subscribing. But it's because it's only a week old, you know. You know, it's in the thousands, so that's exciting. I think women are really taking to this idea. I was amazed. I went to the News Magazine Facebook page where they posted a piece that they had done about us, and we got 2,000 likes and 1,000 shares, and I was just so overwhelmed by that and grateful.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there's a real hunger for women to read really great stories by and about women. And, you know, some of them are funny, some of them are light, some of them are very serious, dealing with difficult situations. My, you know, main criterion, really the only criterion for publishing, is that it has to be well-written and a compelling story.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want people who go to SheBooks to feel like they've kind of walked into a boutique where everything's high quality. Not everything mm-hmm. may fit you, but everything you're going to know is high quality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've published some really exciting things. Last week we published Jennifer Finney Boylan's original novella, I'll Give You Something to Cry About. And Jennifer is the co-chair of GLAAD. And Of GLAAD.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The biggest, I think, gay, lesbian, trans, GBG, whatever the initials are, organization. And she also was recently appointed to Barnard College as a writer in residence, as I think the first woman not born a woman to be appointed as a seven sister. And her book is about a young trans, a trans teen. And I just thought it's so cool to be a publisher that's publishing a transgender writer who's writing about a transgender teen. It's something that, you know, at a length that is hard to publish. So mm-hmm. it's really exciting to give, you know, women voices like that. Or, you know, just as another example of a voice that wouldn't make it into the mainstream media, probably, we've published Faith Adiele, who's an amazing writer out of Oakland. She wrote a book called The Nigerian Nordic Girl's Guide to Lady Problems. And and it's basically a story about fibroids, which you would never read, but it's about kind of the way women's health issues are overlooked, particularly a women's health issue that disproportionately affects African-American women. And she managed to tell this story with the most humor. I mean, she made going to the gynecologist's office hilarious, and also wrote very deftly about these issues of, you know, the white doctors in Iowa just telling her at the age of 30 to have a hysterectomy because, you know, they just didn't know how to deal with that. And, you know, so we have an incredible diversity of voices and writers telling stories that are telling, you know, really the bigger picture. I mean, you talked earlier about how, you know, so much of the definition of news is inherently gender biased. And I think that's true because news has been seen as something that's black and white. It's something that's, you know, the world's chopped up into, you know, different things that don't relate to each other. And if you do bring in, you know, these other issues, it seems extraneous. And I think one of the points of having a place where women can write is to say, you know, there are a lot of stories out there that are not being heard that deserve our attention and a lot of voices that aren't being heard. We also recently did a contest with Latina magazine called I Am Latina. And it was just wonderful to get all of these entries from Latino women talking about sort of the moment in their lives when they really felt like their roots made a difference to them. You know, so we're really making, you know, giving a platform to a wide diversity of voices that are not normally heard in the mainstream media. So that's, that's really exciting.
How many, I mean, titles do you, like, have upcoming, you know, at this given time, for example? Like, how often do you publish something new in this platform?
So right now we have, I think, 46 or 48, and then we're publishing two new ones a week.
Wow, that's a lot.
Usually, it is a lot. Usually we publish one fiction and one memoir or one piece of journalism and one memoir. This week we have essays by Marion Winnick that are really hilarious about having a baby after 40. Like, she already had grown kids, she got remarried, and she, you know, decided to have another family after 40 and just what that was like. And she's very funny. And we also have a piece of fiction by Rochelle Shapiro, which, you know, I mean, fiction has been one way that women have always talked about sort of deep emotional issues in their lives, the way the world affects us. So that's, you know, two a week. And then we also have reading guides for book groups because, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm kind of tired of going to book clubs where everyone read the first 100 pages and not the last 200. And so in e-books, you know, there's no excuse. It's an hour of reading. It's just not that hard to read. But our issues are really juicy for book clubs. For example, we have a memoir called Kemp Paradox by a wonderful writer named Barbara Graham, which is about when she was young, she went to summer camp and kind of had a crush on one of the older counselors as girls do, and then at the age of 14 had an affair with this counselor who was 28 years old.
Oh my.
And you know, it took, and the story is about, you know, realizing over the years that was sexual abuse. And you know, I've never read anything about older women and younger girls and the sexual abuse that can happen between them. You hear about it with boys a lot. But I think people hear about girls and think, oh, you know, that's just girls being girls. And so that was such an interesting read, and also such a sort of amazingly honest piece talking about all of the very conflicted emotions that so many people who've had the experience of sexual abuse have had, you know, because you're young, you like the attention, you like the way it feels, and coming to terms with that as an adult, it's just an amazing piece.
Yeah, it's amazing. Wow, so you can really get into some, I think I know Barbara Graham, actually. You can really get into some, some really unusual corners of human reality through this, which is fantastic, of course. That's fascinating.
And just really honest, you know, we have a piece by Mona Gable called Blood Brother about finding out that her brother had Huntington's disease.
Oh, my.
Which meant that she had a 50% chance of having it herself, which is, a death sentence. And her agonizing decision whether to get tested, whether to find out, you know, is just a really, really compelling read. And a lot of our books go into issues that people have a hard time talking about. Atmospheric Disturbances by Maggie Mae Etheridge is a beautiful book about living with a husband who has bipolar disorder. Confessions of a Reluctant Caregiver by Ariel Gore is about what happens when you are stuck in a caretaking role with someone, as a family member you have serious issues with, and how do you deal with that? So it's, you know, a lot of them are just are very honest, in-depth, beautifully written pieces.
That's a really terrific thing. And so basically also the size of the stories, you know, in terms of the length and then the frequency means that people also are, you know, they're kind of being given new stories and getting new perspectives every week if they have the time, you know, and take the time to read them. Are there book clubs forming around, you know, the people who are following your platform and reading these books, or do people kind of more just pick and choose which ones they read? And how is, I guess maybe too soon to say since you're relatively new.
Right, but we're certainly hoping that we'll have SheBooks book clubs forming. We're already doing some SheBooks readings, which are fun. We call them SheBooks SheBangs. We're doing one in Portland. We're doing one in Austin where our writers get together and read. We basically are hoping eventually to just really encourage a lot of women to tell their stories.
Mm-hmm.
And whether, you know, we publish them or not, just to feel empowered to write their story, tell their story, and, you know, just by the example of these writers, to feel like, you know, their life experience, what they have to say is meaningful, and to make meaning out of it. You know, one of the great things about memoir is, you know, you take a step back and you from your circumstances and dive deeper and come up with, you know, some sort of an emotional truth that is hard won and worth passing along to the reader. And that's that's what makes a story.
That's really interesting, very tantalizing. Great stuff. And then you also recompense the writers in some kind of way. How does that work?
We do. One of the things that we feel is really important is to pay women writers and to pay all writers. And one of the reasons that we've done the ebook model is, you know, magazines have been shrinking and shrinking. And in the process, you know, writing has become content, which is free on the Internet. And you have these essentially writing plantations where
that's
the writers
right.
aren't getting paid for the content at all, which is,
that's right.
It's really blurred the line between what's promotion and what's journalism. I mean, if you go on Huffington Post, they don't pay their writers And, you know, from their point of view, they're giving these people a platform. But what you end up with is people who are just, you know, promoting themselves. And that's fine if you know that that's what that platform is all about, but don't call it journalism. And the space for journalism and people getting paid to write, you know, is really shrinking. And so, you know, a similar thing's been happening in the publishing world where publishers, you know, take 90% of the cover price of every book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because the business is shrinking, they're putting all of their resources into their top writers. I mean, it's you know, sort of a polarization that's happening in society is happening in the publishing world, too. If you're already a rich writer, you're going to make money, basically, or if you're one who's kind of hit the jackpot. But all of the mid-list writers are really, really suffering, just like the middle class is suffering, you know, in this country. And and it's a model that's broken. Both of those models are broken. And so the challenge is to find a model that is sustaining for writers and for readers. So what we do is we give our writers a 50% revenue share on the back end. So whatever, you know, we make, whatever we bring in, we give them 50% of, which is like kind of a fair deal. They wrote it, we published it, we paid the cover designer, we're doing publicity. And then we also give them an advance against that rev share, sort of the way a traditional publisher would, so that, you know, we're saying, you know, here's $1,000 to write a memoir because it's taking your time and you need to be compensated. You know, that's not brilliant compensation, but it's what we can afford right now. And again, it's the reason that we are making a big push to raise money through our Kickstarter campaign so that, you know, SheBooks can pay women writers. And because it's important that we're compensated for these stories.
Yes, indeed, because, you know, here I couldn't agree more because I know exactly what you're talking about. As a writer for 25 years myself and someone,
yeah,
you know, in the media. And, you know, so, you know, you go onto the internet, onto Facebook, and you see all these memes about, you know, you're worth this and stand up for your this and that. And then, you know, then you basically have to donate your profession and everybody else in the world. Out there in the blogosphere, happy to get any renown and, you know, give away their writing. I mean, I was actually Huffington Post's first health reporter going back to 2007, and I can tell you that the most frequent question I get in life is, how do I get on to Huffington? And I, you know, I felt like saying to people, hello, this is my job. I was doing it 20 years before Huffington came along. How do you think it is for me if 100 other people, I open the gate, and again, no one's compensating me and saying, thank you for recruiting for us, you know, here's the percentage.
Yeah.
And, you know, you open the gate, and then all of these people who have jobs are, you know, writing about whatever, you know, they're trying to promote in their, in, you know, in terms of their work or their advocacy. You know, so there you have it. I couldn't agree more, and I hope that our listeners will support the SheBooks campaign by going on Kickstarter, because we really do need a new model. You know, a lot of the content that's out there is also repurposed for this reason. So, you know, there are fewer and fewer outlets, and we really do have, you know, a very broken, blockbuster-oriented system, just as you described. So I hope, you know, that your model succeeds and creates that opportunity for many, many people. And I've actually harangued the listeners on this. You know, when I speak on this topic, of course, it sounds very self-serving because I'm, you know, I'm a writer. And so people are like, oh, well, you're just grousing, you know, have a positive attitude. And I'm like, you know, no, I'm actually a reporter, and I report on different things going on in our society, and this is one of them. And, you know, this affects me personally in my vocation and my income, But, you know, climate change will affect me personally. Polluting our water will affect me personally. So, you know, we're supposed to be objective about these societal injustices and inequities, but actually they do affect a lot, you know, oneself personally. I write about many things that don't affect me personally as well, but if I see, you know, children harmed, children's health harmed, species going extinct, I mean, does that affect me personally? You know, it affects our whole ecosystem, and that affects me personally. So, you know, I don't think we've done a, you know, I think it's really important to, you know, start initiatives like this one and to realize that everything that is going on is affecting us personally, and strengthening the ability of women to speak up and speak out and have a platform to do it, whether you're a man or a woman, whether you write or whether you don't, affects all of us personally. So a pitch for going to Kickstarter and supporting She Books.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, because we're really, it's coming down to the last days, and we're definitely nervous. So I do hope people will support us and support women writers, because all of our money goes directly to women writers. So.
Well, I'm going to be turning around and pitching to you. I can tell you that much. Because, you know, we really sorely needed a new model. And this sounds like an equitable model and an interesting model and a doable model as well. So, you know, it's terrific. And, you know, I wish you, us, and everyone a lot of success with it, really. I think it's very important. Are there any copycats out there, or other initiatives like what you're doing that you model this on, or who copied you, or how is that going?
Well, I think that, you know, there are a lot of people who are playing with different models in this space. There are, you know, there are definitely other subscription services out there. One of the things that makes us different is that we publish original and, well, mostly original and curated pieces. So, you know, you can subscribe to something like Oyster or Scribd and get, you know, all the ebooks you want, but it's essentially a paid library card. There's just this, it gives you access to a lot of books, which is great, but there's no sort of saying what's good, you know, other than the usual bestseller lists, and we can have a whole conversation about how bestsellers happen. And so it's, you know, we're, you know, a place you can go again where you know that whatever you're going to read is high quality, you're getting a certain point of view. There are other places that do long-form journalism, which is great. They all sort of have different models. Byliner is a model that's somewhat similar to ours, except that they tend to focus on, you know, sort of the few writers at the top, and they also publish a lot of pieces that have been previously published, which I think in journalism doesn't necessarily work that well because things are so often so timely. Our journalism, we try to make more almost sociological, you know, something that is a peek into different people's lives, a peek into an issue, and something that's going to hopefully last. You know, we'll want to read that story 6 months from now. It's just, it's not, you know, and I think that what we've been talking about here with nature of news is so important, because we have been told that a story is a very, you know, it's not about connecting the dots, as, you know, as the title of your show. It's, you know, it's like things happen in a vacuum, and people just report on that little thing.
That's right.
And if you're not getting the big picture, you aren't going to understand how everything affects you and how everything is connected. You know, it's like if, you know, people who eat organic vegetables just because they think it's going to prevent them from getting cancer because no chemicals are going into their own body. It's like, well, okay, yes, but let's look at the chemicals that are going into the earth, and let's look at the whole system, and let's look at the people who are working to pick those vegetables. I mean, it's about looking at the really big picture, and so often that doesn't happen with mainstream
journalism. Well, that's my whole argument for everything I write. You just hit it right on the head there, because I've been a health journalist covering integrative approaches to health and nutrition for 20 years, and it's not enough. I mean, we also have to maintain the organic standards so that, you know, slush doesn't come into it and all kinds of other things. There are constant industry pressures. So the idea that, you know, organic means what organic meant or was intended to mean even, or will mean or can mean that in a context where you have pollution, GMOs, and everything else. You know, we've been taught to think exclusively as consumers. And, you know, I'm all powerful, I bought organic, whatever. But unless you defend organic and unless you look at the whole food system, then it really, does everyone have that option? Is everyone eating healthy food? Or are you participating in an elitist, injustice, basically, and saluting yourself? In other words, I think the first wave of all of that health and food stuff, which I participated in and promoted from very early on, was great. But if we don't make it systemic and extend it to everyone, then it really becomes a form of neoliberalism, honestly, and very self-serving. Yeah. And then that's not even healthy. You know, it's not actually healthy in the most holistic sense. Well, anyway, they're playing the music because it's time for us to say goodbye this week. But this has been a fascinating conversation. Go to Kickstarter, everybody. Contribute to She Books. Thank you so much for being with us this week, Laura Fraser. Love what you're doing.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate your support.
All right. And come back next week, listeners, to Connect the Dots for more kick-ass, kindly commentary on how we connect the dots between our health and our society. Do something this week. Contribute to She Books. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Have a great week.